Morning.
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 So this morning I'm going to continue, this is probably the, I don't know, I lost track, maybe the 10th or 15th talk I've given on faith, heart, mind, inscription, and I'm going line by line through it, and the lines that I'm talking about today are in your program. And I'm about 90% through, I think. And today I'm gonna use the same model of talking about the lines that I used about last time, which is the model that comes from Dongshan or Tozan, who was one of the founders of Soto Zen. Dongshan is his Chinese name, Tozan is his Japanese name, and Soto comes from the To in Tozan's name. Okay? And last time I talked about the five-pronged diamond, which is one of the things that he stresses in his teaching. And those five prongs include shift, submission to practice, caring about others, shift, submission to practice, non-discriminating awareness, caring about others, and ordinary life. So, the quote I'm going to talk about today, simply say when doubt arises not to. That's where I left off last time. Just simply say when doubt arises not to. In this not to, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. No matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. And this truth is beyond extension or diminution in time or space. In it, a single thought is 10,000 years. Emptiness here, emptiness there. But the infinite universe stands always before our eyes. So this five-pronged diamond as an expression is meant to be an expression of ontology, which is a big word just for being. Dogen says whole being, Buddha nature. So it's an ontology, an expression of being, of who we and what we are in the world. And also it's considered sometimes developmentally. So you move from the first prong, which is shift, to the last prong, which is ordinary life. As I said last time. So, the last line from last time was, just simply say when doubt arises, not to, which is T-W-O. And that's the shift that we're making. We're trying to make a shift as practitioners of this way. It's been passed down to us and that we really care about, from the egocentric to the life-centric, to the cosmocentric. We're trying to make the shift moment after moment in our lives, whether we're experienced meditators or unexperienced meditators, whether we're teachers or students, or whether we're not even students. If you want to have a full life, making this shift is what gives you the opportunity to have a full life. So, I talk a lot about my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, and you're going to hear, I'm going to talk a lot about him again today. So, my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, came to the United States in 1959. And when he was a young man, when he was 23, he met a British lady. And the British lady's name was Miss Ransom. And Miss Ransom taught him English. She was his English teacher. And then Miss Ransom was was, he was 23, I think she was 40 or something. She was very tall, like 6 feet. He was like 4'10". And they would truck around together. And she taught him English. And then, after about 3 or 4 years into this, she started getting interested in Buddhism. So she was his first Western Buddhist student. And she was so receptive and so interested and so free from the accoutrements of traditional Buddhism that he thought, oh, beginner's mind. This is wonderful. I finally found someone who I can really teach. I want to go to that part of the world. I want to be there. In his 20s. And you can read about this in his big biography, right? But then he had no opportunity to come for a long, long time until he was 55. You know, World War II, da-da-da, all the stuff that went on, his teacher's expectations for him, the temple that he had to take care of. Finally, at 55, he had a chance to come. But he didn't know any difference between Britain and America, and he certainly didn't know San Francisco in the 60s. So he thought he was going to a culture which was like Miss Ransom's culture, a culture where the emphasis was on restraint, like the Japanese, restraint. Not this letting it all hang out stuff. What did that even mean? He thought it was a culture which valued hierarchy. The teacher is here, the student is here, the father is here, the daughter is here, the granddaughter is here, the man is here, the woman is here. The men walk in front of the women. And Miss Ransom seemed to get all that stuff. He thought English-speaking people were like that. Then he really liked the way Miss Ransom drank her tea. He thought, oh, the British people, the people who speak English, have a nice way of drinking tea, just like us. There's an etiquette to it. It's a little simpler. But when he came to San Francisco, was there any interest in etiquette in the 60s in San Francisco? So what did he get? What did he do at 55? Well, he came to San Francisco, and he had to really work on making a great shift. That's the first prong. Making a great shift from the culture-centric, the person-centric, to the something big, supposedly cosmic-centric or life-centric. And he did it pretty well. If he hadn't done it pretty well, we wouldn't be here today. And it didn't look like it was a struggle for him. It looked like it was pretty easy for him, but it must have been at times a real struggle for him. I mean, how can it not have been? I remember taking him to an art exhibit in San Francisco, or going with him. I didn't take him. Going with him. And I said, this is modern art, sensei. And he said, what's modern art? And I said, well, you'll see. And it was Jackson Pollock. So... And, you know, so we went through the whole, he was quiet for the whole time, he didn't say anything. We went through the whole exhibit. We got home, he still didn't say anything except thank you very much. And the next morning, he gave his talk on a Sunday morning, and he talked about how he had been to this very strange art exhibit, but how it had the same underlying spirit as the great Japanese Sumi masters, the same underlying spirit. And it was the spirit of whole being Buddha nature. So he was pretty good. He made that shift pretty well, generally. Not always, but generally. Another thing I remember is when we were down at the Zen monastery that we started south of San Francisco. And early when we were down there, we had great hot baths. We had wonderful hot baths. You know, natural sulfur springs are still there. They've been there for a long, long time. And remember, we were pretty much counterculture people, so we would just go into those hot baths and just strip down. You know, men and women, just strip down, play in the water and the hot baths and go into the river, back into the, Well, first time I was down there with Suzuki Roshi. You've got to remember that in Japanese culture, men don't even show their genitals to other men. When they're in the baths, men keep them covered. Keep them covered like this. When they get out of the bath, they have a little towel over themselves, or a little. They keep their hands over themselves. So there we were, whatever we were doing, gallivanting around, and he was there too. But I could tell he was having a hard time shifting. He was having a hard time shifting, and I noticed that when he got out of the bath, he reached right for his towel. And we didn't get to continue that skinny dipping too long. We got to continue it for about a month. I don't know why I even let us do it for a month. And then the word came out, this was a monastery. Oh, a monastery? What's that? So shifting, because he had a real deep desire to show the Dharma, to manifest the Dharma in his life. And we all come across situations continually where we have to remind ourselves, either that or just revert to our more kind of tribal, instinctual, egocentric way of being. So that first facet, that first prong of the diamond goes with the second prong, which is submission to practice, as I was talking about last time. Submission to practice. And last time I talked a lot about the spirit of repetition. But sometimes we don't even have the spirit of repetition to support us. Sometimes, like in his situation, sure, he could do his zazen over and over again, but then he had to go out in the street. Then he had to go down to the hot springs where the people were men and women were cavorting while they were bathing. Then he had to get in a car where somebody was going to take him someplace to an event and it reeked of marijuana. I remember one of these situations. And it wasn't me, you guys. Very clearly remember one of these situations. And the marijuana odor was in the car, and nobody... And of course, he could smell it really. We could smell it in the Zendo because people would smoke their joints and then come do zazen. So he knew what it was by then. He knew what it was, and nobody had the audacity to do it in front of him. And people thought it was good prep for zazen. Anyway, I won't get too much into this. But so anyway, in the car. He just had to submit to being in the car with him and just being there, just completely being there, whole being, submitting to practice. So practice isn't then something special. It's whatever your life gives you. Whatever your life gives you. It's not some special activity. And if you're a Japanese Zen teacher and your life gives you a car that smells of marijuana, you just sit there, breathe, and are friendly to people. And then if anybody asks you something, as people did, he'd say, I'm not for or against marijuana. I'm just trying to show people our way. That's all he ever said. So, in the poem that we've been working on for 10 weeks, in this not to, nothing is separate, nothing is excluded, no matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. So enlightenment's not a specific experience that we need or want. I'm sure you want it, but not a specific experience. It's entering whatever truth there is here, whatever situation you've got here, in your body, in your mind, in your family, in your life, completely entering it. So last weekend, I was with my wife and son in northeast Alabama. I've never been to the South before. I'm not sure if I'll ever go again. I might. And northeast Alabama is the reddest part of Alabama, okay? We've got red and blue states, and then we've got triple red. Northeast Alabama is like triple red. And we were there because my nephew was graduating from high school. I have a sister with schizophrenia, and she's never been able to take care of him, although she lives down there. She kind of just moved down there and never been able to take care of him. Doesn't even acknowledge he's her son. Think what it's like. What would it be like growing up like that? So I always tell her, and she said, "Oh yeah, that's what people say." And they live together, and this is the other woman takes care of my sister and him, and he's come up every summer since he was 9 years old to be with us because he has no other relatives down there, none. So he went down for his high school graduation. Talk about a need to shift. Talk about a need to submit to just what is. We were primed. We kind of knew what we were getting into because my son had been down there already. I had not been down there. But doesn't mean it was any easier. The culture for us, for me and my wife and son, and probably for most of you guys, was more foreign than European culture. Definitely more foreign than European culture. My grandson and daughter live in France, and this culture was way more foreign than that. Way more foreign. But it is human beings trying to get along, just like we are, trying to live a life, having certain values, having certain ways of doing things. And so to try to make the shift. So we tried to make the shift because we had a deep desire to support this young man, a deep desire. And the fourth prong of the diamond is caring about others. Sometimes if you really care about someone, you can just manifest the diamond, even in an awful situation, because you care so much about them. And then you just manifest it. And I was just watching my wife and son and how good a job they were doing. And we went into restaurants, you know, and all they had was fried food and meat, fried food. And we wanted to... And my wife and son are vegetarians. I'm not vegetarian, so it wasn't so bad for me. So we wanted to order an omelet in the morning, but and they had ham and bacon omelets, ham, bacon, and sausage omelets. Well, no sausage, thank you. No ham, thank you. No bacon. And then Linda said, and no cheese, because she doesn't eat cheese. And Jed doesn't eat cheese either. They're a little allergic to cheese, right? And the woman started looking disgusted with us. Just disgusted. And then I said, well, and how about some vegetables? Because I'd seen that you could get mushrooms and hot peppers. I said, how about putting vegetables in the omelet? And she said, vegetables? And I said, yes, mushrooms and hot peppers. And then she looked just completely disgusted at us. Anyway, I could go on and on. It was like that. And this is, everybody there loves George W. Bush. Everyone loves him. For him, he's the man. What he's doing in Iraq is really, really helping people for them. On Saturday, I heard my wife say to my nephew, so my nephew goes to a fundamentalist church. There isn't anything but fundamentalism down there, I don't think. My nephew goes to a fundamentalist church. I've had him up here. He's come here, heard a lecture here. He was very quiet afterwards. He goes to a fundamentalist church. I heard my wife say, do you want us to go to church with you? And I thought, wow, Linda's saying that? Because my wife is, well, I won't talk about this part, but I'm kind of receptive to Christianity. I like Christianity. But my wife hasn't had good experiences with it. But my wife's saying, shall we go to church with you, Nick? And Nick said, oh, that would be wonderful. And then I realized Linda was doing that because he goes to this church, he has no family. He goes there and she wanted to be there with him. So she was willing to put all of her prejudices aside and just go to that church. And I thought, oh, God, do we have to do this? But I saw Linda could do that. If Linda can do that, I can do that. You know, if you care, you can do all kinds of things. And so we went, and it wasn't too bad. We tried to sit in the very back of the church, but then Nick came and said, oh, we need to sit, my nephew, we need to sit in the front and meet the pastor. So we didn't have to go up when people went up and sort of, I don't know what they do exactly. You know, they go down, and I guess they're giving themselves to Jesus. I don't know. I don't know much about this. We didn't have to do that part. Although, I wouldn't have minded doing that. By that time, I kind of got into it, you know. So shift. Shift and submission to practice. Two prongs of the diamond. In this not two, nothing is separate. Nothing is excluded. No matter when or where. No matter when or where. Whatever your situation is. Enlightenment means entering. Just entering. Okay, now I'm going to read a portion of a poem by Kenneth Cook. Now, I don't know anything about Kenneth Cook. I don't know if he knows anything about Buddhism. But I noticed yesterday that my wife was reading a book on poetry. And I said, oh, what are you reading? And this is what she was reading. I'm not going to do the whole poem. And this is a poem, really, this about shift and about maybe something like the whole diamond manifesting itself when we shift. A serious moment for the water is when it boils. And though one usually regards it merely as a convenience to have the boiling water available for bath or table, occasionally there is someone around who understands the importance of this moment for the water. Maybe a saint, maybe a poet, maybe a crazy artist, or just somebody temporarily disturbed. This practice, if you try to shift, you will be disturbed. You'll get disturbed. That's a good sign. That means you're really trying to shift. How many people I have drunk tea or coffee with and thought about the boiling water hardly at all, just waiting for it to boil, so there could be coffee or chocolate or tea. The water boils almost every time the same old way and still is serious because it is boiling. This is what I think one should see. From this may come compassion. A serious moment for the fly is when its wings are moving. And a serious moment for the duck is when it swims. When it first touches water, then spreads its smile upon the water, its feet begin to paddle. It is in and above the water, pushing itself forward. A duck. And a serious moment for the sky is when, completely blue, it feels some clouds coming. Another when it turns dark. A serious moment for the match is when it bursts into flame and is all alone, living in that instant, that beautiful second for which it was made. So much went into it. The men at the match factory, the mood of the public, the sand covering the barn. So it was hard to find the phosphorus. And now this flame. This pink, white, ecstatic, light blue. For the telephone when it rings, for the wind when it blows, and for the match when it bursts into flame. Serious. All our life is serious, and we see around us seriousness for other things that touches us and seems as if it might be giving clues. The seriousness of the house when it is being built and is almost completed, and then the moment when it is completed, the seriousness of the bee when it stings. We say, he has taken his life merely to sting. Why should he do that? And we feel we aren't concentrated enough. Not pure, not deep, as the buzzing bee. The bee flies into the house and lights on a chair arm and sits there waiting for something to be other than it is so he can fly again. He is boiling, waiting. Soon he is forgotten and everyone is speaking again. A serious moment. Whole being Buddha nature moment. Are there any other moments? Do you think so? Okay, now moving on to the third prong, which I talked about before too, non-discriminating awareness. That's the one everybody likes the best. Everybody wants that prong, right? So is this in this not two? Nothing is separate, nothing is excluded. No matter when or where, enlightenment means entering this truth. And this truth is beyond time or space. Non-discriminating awareness, beyond time or space. So Wei Ning went to see Hung Jen. And Hung Jen was the teacher, and Hung Jen said to Wei Ning, "In South China, where you come from, I understand there is no Buddha Dharma. Northeast Alabama, where my nephew lives, there is definitely no Buddha Dharma." We were exhausted when we came home, just exhausted. Shifting is exhausting. I don't have to tell you that. "In South China, where you come from, I understand there is no Buddha Dharma." And what does Wei Ning say? Wei Ning, the smartass Zen master to be. "The Buddha Dharma knows no south, north, east, or west. The Buddha Dharma knows no south, north, east, or west." Non-discriminating awareness. And non-discriminating awareness comes partly from our big, deep desire to shift. Comes partly from our desire to help people, but also it is Manjushri's non-discriminating awareness. Manjushri is the meditation master. He is the meditation master, and he's the meditation master because of what? His sword. Because with his sword, he deconstructs everything. Right. He deconstructs all of our cultural baggage, all of our political baggage, all of our personal, interpersonal baggage. Deconstructs it, deconstructs it, deconstructs it. And we could say that there are different levels of deconstruction. We don't need to get too caught on it, but in a way there are different levels of deconstruction in the meditation process. And those accord with how deep your meditation is. There's been a lot of research done in the last 40 years on meditators and on brainwaves, and then on meditators in daily life. A lot of meditation is continuing to go on. And in Zazen, in daily life, we're mostly beta wave activity. And the oscillations are 15 to 30 oscillations per second. That's a lot, isn't it? But think of our minds. It's not surprising, right? 15 to 30 per second. Well, then, if we get into, from beta, we get down to alpha waves in our Zazen, we experience some calmness in between our thoughts, some space. Our thoughts are still coming. There's still some chattering, but we experience that calmness. And we get more into a beta mode. So that's like Manjushri's first slice. There's some deconstruction of all that chattering and some experience of, oh, boy, I can just sit here. I don't have to be just tossed away by all that stuff. And they started this work, as far as I know, about 40 years ago. And I can remember being with Suzuki Roshi one morning in the mid-morning when he said, he had just been to the psychologist. And I said, "Oh, you've been to the psychologist?" He said, "Yes, the psychologist." I said, "What did he do?" He said, "Oh, he put electrodes on my head." And he said, "Was testing my brain waves." And he said, "But you know, last night I had to stay up late, so I was pretty sleepy. I don't think I did a good job." So the early studies were mostly about alpha waves and beta waves, and about how in meditation you could reduce the waves, reduce the oscillations from 15 to 30 to 10 to 15. So that's Manjushri's first slice, and we can all benefit from this. It doesn't always happen, but yeah, in the spirit of repetition, it does happen if you keep going in your meditation. And then they kept doing studies of more experienced meditators, and then they started looking at after beta waves, alpha waves, then theta waves. Well, what's theta waves? 5 to 10 oscillations per second. And theta waves are, we experience them as human beings only when we just wake up and when we're just going to sleep, according to the research, unless we're doing meditation. You know, that twilight zone. When we're just waking up and we're just going to sleep, especially if we've had a deep sleep. That twilight zone, which has a lot of sort of psychic energy to it, and it's the in this poem that I've been doing, this heart mind poem, it's this truth which is beyond time and space. In a single thought, it is 10,000 years. A lot of paranormal activity can occur, especially in retreats. Especially if you're in some kind of a sesshin or retreat, or if you're living in a monastic or semi-monastic life, because you're getting so calm, so still that you're, of course, Jung would say you're sinking into the collective unconscious. Well, I don't know about that, but I know that these experiences happen, and I know that most Buddhists value them a lot. In Zen, there's some ambivalence about them, and that's because people get so attached to them. It becomes then sort of another sort of, Katagiri Roshi would have said, toy. But nevertheless, they happen, and they're a good sign, usually, if you start to, if you're on your sixth day of sesshin and you're looking at the wall, and all of a sudden you see through the wall, you see out into the yard, that's a good sign. That means you're in some theta activity, and you don't need to think theta. You're just in it. Now, some Zen teachers, if you came to them, they say, "Oh," but I say, "Oh," just don't get too attached, you know. So Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi never talked about this stuff. And we would ask them about it, but they would never talk about it. But you could tell they had psychic awareness. You could tell they did. Everybody could tell it. They just didn't talk about it because they didn't want people to get too attached, and they didn't want to advertise. And so once I was with Suzuki Roshi, and we were going down for the opening of the Zen monastery in Carmel Valley. And Dichi Suzuki had died the month before. So there are two prominent Suzukis in the history of Zen. There's Shinryu Suzuki and then Dichi Suzuki, who came earlier. All the early books are written either by Dichi Suzuki or then Alan Watts. Dichi Suzuki was a Rinzai teacher. I didn't think he had ever met Shinryu Suzuki. I'd never heard Shinryu Suzuki mention him. But here we were going down to the opening of this first Zen monastery in the United States. You know, everybody was high about it. And Suzuki Roshi was high, too, because this little group of hippies had raised, I don't know how much we raised, $100,000, which is a lot of money then, to do this thing. So it was just the two of us in the car, and he said, "Tim, D.T. Suzuki will be there." But I knew that D.T. Suzuki had died just 3 or 4 weeks before. I said to him, "Sensei, you said D.T. Suzuki?" He said, "Yes, D.T. Suzuki." Well, I was young then, and I was a little bit in awe of him, so I didn't have the audacity to say, "What do you mean by that? How do you know?" I began to then see more how he could tune into things, how he tuned into things. He talked very little about it. One night when I, after I'd been practicing at the Zen monastery for 2 months, and then he left the Zen monastery to go to San Francisco, I had a dream. And in the dream he was there, and he told me something. And then next morning he came down from San Francisco to the Zen monastery, and I saw him in Doksan, and he told me exactly the thing he told me in the dream the night before. And I said, "Sensei, you already told me that in a dream last night." And he just looked at me. He didn't say anything. I thought, well, does he know he told me? Well, I don't know. I don't know. Why do you have to tell me again? You know. Anyway, that's the theta level. That's cutting through beyond the alpha level into the theta level by really slowing down, really slowing down. And then the bottom level, the foundation, is the delta. Delta 1 to 3 oscillations per second. Going from 15 to 30 to 1 to 3. We call that samadhi in Buddhism. We call that emptiness. It doesn't matter what you call it. You call it anything you want. Whatever you call it is irrelevant. Completely irrelevant. But call it that. Call it irrelevant. That's fine. So in the poem we've been talking about the last few weeks, and this truth is beyond time or space. In it, a single thought is 10,000 years. Emptiness here, emptiness there. Emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. That's Manjushri. That's Manjushri's third swipe of the sword, which we can all experience through our Zazen practice. It's hard to do it, though, just in daily Zazen. You really need to do some retreat practice to have it. It's possible in daily Zazen as a complement to retreat practice. Now, on to the last two prongs. The last two prongs, helping others, I talked about already, so I won't talk much about that. And ordinary life. Ordinary life. We can say that Manjushri is the master of non-discriminating awareness. And then Vimalakirti is the master of taking care of others in ordinary life. Caring for others. Not taking care of, caring for others. You could say that. You could use some other bodhisattvas too, but today I'm using Manjushri. So the story about, Vimalakirti. So the story about Vimalakirti, some of you know Vimalakirti, some of you read the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra, some of you studied it, some of you have never heard of him. So Vimalakirti is a teacher. He's not even a teacher, he's just a layman. He lives in the world, he's got a wife, this is in Buddhist time, a wife and family. He's very wealthy, a very, very wealthy person. But he's considered very wise. And Buddha hears that Vimalakirti is ill. So he wants to send someone to see Vimalakirti, to give support to Vimalakirti, to find out how Vimalakirti is doing. So who does he send? Who does he send?
Well, he tries to send everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, so who ends up going? Manjushri. Yeah. He tries to send up everybody. Nobody will go, but then Manjushri goes, right? The bodhisattva with the sword, the bodhisattva who deconstructs everything. He's going to deconstruct Vimalakirti's illness too, right? So he goes to see Vimalakirti. And Vimalakirti is in a 10x10 room, tiny room, right? Supposedly the Doksan room is 10x10, the 10x10 rooms for 2,500 years. I don't know why, but he's in a 10x10 room, and he goes in the room, and he sees that the room is Vimalakirti is there in the bed, sick in the bed, and the room is full of beings. There are all kinds of beings there. There are bodhisattvas and devas and hell-dwelling beings and well people and sick people and most of those people have some maladies, and so Manjushri is just surprised when he sees the interpenetration of all these people in this 10-foot room, right? And Vimalakirti there, sick in bed, but Vimalakirti doesn't look sick to him. Vimalakirti looks like he's ministering to all these people. He's helping all these people. And he says to Vimalakirti, so he puts his sword away. He immediately puts his sword away. And he stops and watches Vimalakirti. And he listens to Vimalakirti, and he learns from Vimalakirti. Now, I'm probably, exaggerating this a little bit, but I don't know. No, they exaggerate it more than I do. Actually, no, they exaggerate it a lot more than I do. If you look at these old sutras, they really exaggerate stuff. And Vimalakirti says, as long as one being is sick, I will be sick. As long as one being is suffering physically, I will be suffering physically. I am here for them. And then he talks to Manjushri about the practice of being there for others, about the practice of letting go of some idea of deconstruction, some idea of cutting away. We have enough cuts already. We have enough wounds already. Do we need to create some more wounds? He talks to Vimalakirti about just using your own wound to open up to someone else's. So now, I'm going to finish off with another part of the same poem that Linda showed me yesterday. And it's a poem that's about what it's about. We're still on serious moments, though. It's a whole poem that goes on for about 5 pages about what it considers serious moments. And in this case, in Vimalakirti's case, a serious moment is a moment when your pain is a way of opening rather than a way of closing. When your weakness is a way of supporting people rather than feeling like you're not up to supporting them. Because that's where you find your strength. That's where you find your strength. And people are moved by that. People are touched by that. And that's just ordinary life. That's all it is. Just ordinary life. It's always coming up. If it hasn't come up yet, it's going to be coming up this afternoon or this evening or tomorrow. That you'll feel wounded or somebody else will feel wounded and you have a chance to just open up. Just be there with them. Which means being there with yourself, right? Okay, back to Kenneth Cook. A serious moment for the island is when its trees begin to give it shade. Oh, that's nice. And another is when the ocean washes big, heavy things against its side. One walks around and looks at the island, but not really at it, at what is on it. And one thinks, it must be serious, even, to be this island at all. Here, since it is lying here exposed to the whole sea, all its moments might be serious. It is serious in such windy weather to be a sail, or an open window, or a feather flying in the street. Seriousness. How often have I thought of seriousness, and how little I have understood it? Except this, serious is urgent, and it has to do with change. You say to the water, it's not necessary to boil now, and you turn it off. It stops fidgeting and starts to cool. Sooner or later, it stops fidgeting and starts to cool. You may not believe it, but come down to Hokkyoji with us in 3 weeks, and I'll help you. You put your hand in it and say, the water isn't serious anymore. It has the potential, however, the urgency to give off bubbles, to change itself to steam. And the wind, when it becomes part of a hurricane, blowing up the beach, and the sand dunes can't keep it away. Fainting is one sign of seriousness. Crying is another. Shuddering all over is another one. So the 5-pronged diamond, and you don't have to remember anything about it. It's just life. Just whole being, wherever you are. Sometimes wounded, sometimes not wounded. Sometimes boiling, sometimes cooling down. All the moments are serious. But you don't need to try to make them serious. They're serious just as they are. Just as they are. And there's a lot of shifting going on. You may hate shift, but it's going on anyway. You may hate it, but why not join us? Why not completely join us? Do you have any choice? Do I have any choice? Okay. Questions, comments? The name of the poem is Boiling Water by Kenneth Cook, who lived from 1925 to 2002. Maybe some of you who are more literate than I know about this guy. Yeah?
What is the difference between shift and condoning?
Shift and condoning. Shift and condoning. Will you say more about what you mean by that? Shift and condoning.
Let's say that we, I'm in the midst of people who are, using LSD
or
heroin.
Oh.
And so I'm in their midst, and so, I'm sure you're not meeting that.
Oh, yes.
But
yes.
I'm using an extreme example.
Yes, well.
At some point, there will be a conflict.
Yes, well. Suzuki Roshi was like Milton Erickson. Some of you know Milton Erickson. He'd never heard of Milton Erickson. Milton Erickson actually studied all these guys before he came up with... This is a psychiatrist, Milton Erickson. But way before Milton Erickson, Suzuki Roshi knew from his life, from his practice with his teacher, from his sitting, he knew how to join and then lead by joining. He knew that until you completely join, you can't lead. That a leader who doesn't join first is not trusted, is not respected, is not loved. But if you completely join, the leading happens. And you don't even notice it. Those hippies didn't even notice it. They didn't even notice it. I didn't even notice it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you're saying that the key is that discerning or non-discerning awareness.
Right. Uh-huh. It's both discerning and non-discerning. The discerning awareness is pay attention to the other as an other. Discern. This other person, this is a person whose values are being in the moment. Well, that's cool for Zen. But smoking grass and doing LSD, well, that's not exactly how to open up to whole being without being dependent on something. So discriminating, but also non-discriminating, in silence being able, in stillness being able to join, in complete stillness, and moving between discerning awareness and non-discerning, which are not two. It's the shift that's always going on. Anything else? Thank you.